Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats from the VHS era, I guess is how we should describe it. And our film for this episode is Ken Russell's Altered States. From 1980, and in 1980, Altered States was, I guess, kind of a big deal. It was a prestige picture, I think. Yeah. The score, the box says the score was nominated for an Oscar. And we have it on VHS, getting it from, I believe, the Kmart in Edgewood Town Center, which has been closed for years. And actually, until we watched it, this VHS tape was still in the cellophane, as you can tell by our Instagram. If you follow us on Instagram, Nell and Matt's Movies, we opened it live on camera or whatever. Let's dive into
this movie.
This movie. Let's talk about the film.
I think. For me, one of the interesting things is it's William Hurt's first film that he did. So what a way to start your film career in Hollywood, playing this particular role.
Yes, where he's naked for a good third of the picture.
But you do not see his genitalia, which I think
that's
is
very
interesting. Right. So it's perceived nakedness.
Well, you see his ass a lot, so there's...
That's true, that's true.
He might have been butt-casted, or... And I don't think it's a body double, but...
Yeah. And if you're a fan of Stranger Things, the deprivation tank is a huge part of this movie. His first one was definitely borrowed for Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. So when Eleven is going into those other states, they use a very similar tank. Yes. So as we know, the creators of Stranger Things like to reference... other films, and they definitely reference Altered States.
We should explain the plot of this film, because this is one I think has been kind of lost to history. I think I only know about it because, again, in college, we had a professor who was a Jungian who was really into this film. It was really Jungian, really into Ken Russell, really into this film. So this is not a film a lot of people, I think, are going to know or remember.
That's true. So Eddie Jessup is a psychiatrist who's studying schizophrenia. And so he initially starts out using the deprivation tank to basically cut himself off from all stimulus to see what's happening. And it was supposed to be a way of him studying schizophrenia. However, it progresses. Mm-hmm. Over time into something much different than the initial intention, which I will say, so like that part actually is kind of interesting to me because, you know, with schizophrenia, like no one really knows the mechanisms that cause schizophrenia, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of theories out there, whether it's like a dopamine issue, whether it's bilateralism in the brain. A lot of schizophrenics actually are left-handed, you know, so there's like this kind of interesting research around potentially why. But one of the theories out there for schizophrenia is that the filter mechanisms that allow us to screen out a lot of stimuli are not functioning appropriately for schizophrenics. And also like recall. So you might have a memory from childhood that suddenly floods into your brain. It makes me think of when my grandmom was going blind. And if her brain was like struggling to fill in for information and would occasionally pull like a memory from years past. And so you could be sitting with her and she would say, "I see the children running in the house," and there was no children. She was in her, in her 90s. So, you know, part of it is that, you know, is the brain is not necessarily able to function the way it should and it's not filtering out stimulus. So in some ways, like the deprivation tank would almost, if you believe that method, if you believe that, the deprivation tank would also almost mimic what it's like to be schizophrenic, that your brain isn't able to filter.
A brain deprived of external stimulus, right? So the idea of the central deprivation tank is this, you know, body temperature, salt water mixture that makes, there's enough salt that it makes a human body buoyant, and you're supposed to kind of float naked in the darkness and the quiet. Yeah. And whatever's maybe in the back of your subconscious now can come rushing and flooding into the, you know, because you don't have your phone to look at or whatever, or the hecticness of modern life or whatever, the overstimulation, all of that is gone. And so, yes, and so he's doing this research on patients and then starts doing the research on himself.
Yes.
Yes.
And I guess we should also mention the history of the deprivation tank. So,
yes.
It was John Lilly was the one who invented the deprivation tank. He was the one who came up with the concept of floating in salt water and to block off all stimuli for it. So he initially started out as a pretty regular researcher and physician. And he kind of took this quite this turn, but so he believed in the trying the deprivation tank. Then he met up with like Timothy Leary and some other counterculture figures, and he started combining the use of LSD and other drugs for people while they're in the deprivation tank to further their experience. But he's probably most infamous for the Peter studies of the dolphin. So if you, it's kind of actually been a
Google
joke.
That.
You have
Google
to Google
that. Google it. It's, Google it.
I want to say Drunk History did a thing on it. Saturday Night Live definitely did a skit on it.
Google it.
But he ends up doing a study where dolphins cohabitate with human beings and things really go off rails. But so the book, the author of the book actually did a lot of research around what Lilly was doing. Mm-hmm. And that was a big influence on what was happening within the book.
Yeah. And so then it's this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde sort of tale.
Yeah.
You know, this is a film that very much wears, I mean, they mention Faust.
Yes.
In the film, this idea of selling your soul to the devil for knowledge, which I guess you could say happens in this film.
Yeah.
So there's that. There is Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. There is a potion that the William Hurt character takes, who then, you know, you always struggle with films like this and spoilers, but it not only alters his consciousness, but you could say it also alters his DNA. He goes back to this original soul or whatever, and he becomes this sort of Neanderthal man or something, or this missing link. And there's a scene where he goes to the zoo and like kills a goat with his bare hands because he's hungry and whatever, but yet still maintains, even as he's recalling this later, his like cold clinical distant college professory. Well, yes, I was so exhilarated by it. Or what? I don't know why I can't do pretension and not do a British accent. Sorry, British people, but it's just how that works.
He's not a very likable character.
He is not a likable character.
So, and I think that in the beginning of the movie, actually, even the seduction scene with his future wife is really bizarre.
AKA grad student in his department.
Yeah.
Which we need to talk about that at some point. Yes.
Why don't we talk about... So I think there's a couple things that we need to touch on with this film, but I do think the portrayal of being a college professor is interesting in this in this movie. I guess it's not sexy or interesting to just do your typical college professor who shows up every day and teaches and does the right thing.
Well, here's what I'll say, though. They do get right, and this was triggering and I felt seen while watching this film. And I think about my own past as an insufferable graduate student, because all graduate students, I think, in order to survive graduate school, to get a doctorate, have to go through this phase where you feel like you are, well, Mr. Ramsey from To the Lighthouse, where you're trying to be the one that gets to Z in the alphabet, and one mind of a generation gets to Z, and maybe, like, in the novel, I think, you know, maybe Mr. Ramsey thinks he's an R. You know, he got to R, but not to Z. You know, this idea, what Virginia Woolf sometimes called the prick of steel Victorian intellect, just sees so clearly and has such knowledge and is creating new knowledge for the world. And I will say there is an element of that in college professor life, and in some ways for me an attractive element of that. Like the idea, I have a colleague who once said that, you know, in the 80s, Derrida had 12 one-month contracts and would literally go around the world, and especially around the United States, and for a month be member of an English department. And him saying that, you know, the month Derrida was there, who got to Z, you know, he, you know, the people in the department, and at the time he was an insufferable graduate student, felt like they were in the intellectual center of the universe. So you almost need that, like, Lone Ranger, gunslinger attitude, especially among male professors.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also interesting.
That's a big part of it. Yeah. And so, I don't know if this film does a lot of things right, but that might be one of them.
So we, you know, to disclose, both Matt and I have our doctorates, and Matt is in higher education.
Yes.
So I think it's also the fact, and you and I had this conversation before, because there are people who'll go from college to master's to doctorate, and this is definitely what Eddie Jessup has done. So he has his doctorate by the time he's 24, 25, and you think of the choices that he makes at 24 or 25 are very typical of what a 24 or 25-year-old would do. Because we don't want to think about it, but even into our 20s, we're still maturing.
Yeah.
And so I think that gunslinger motive that you're talking about is really also part of maturity.
And also you throw in there this game where it's prestige. You know, Harvard gets name-dropped several times in this film. It's like, oh, you're at Columbia. Well, this person's at Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, and that there is that element to higher ed and higher ed careerism that does very well. And in some ways, while the character, the Jessup character, his motivations are sometimes hard, and I wonder what sort of non-academics or people who aren't familiar with that world would think of this film today. But that helps some of the motivation for his character, because then in his taking his DNA altering hallucinogenic trips in a sensory deprivation tank is profoundly dangerous and threatening to his own life and threatening to the safety of other people. It's in his mind totally worth it, and totally, yes, this is, I'm being responsible, because if I don't discover this, who will? You know, we will break through. You know, he uses the term breakthrough a lot.
I think his wife, Emily, mentions at one point that he's a truth seeker, and like, and he whatever he's doing is the need to find the truth, and he kind of doesn't care what he does to get to what his perceived truth is during it. So, as you mentioned, is it a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde story in that sense of that he kind of is actually kind of jerky.
Oh, yeah, he's insufferable.
Yeah, he's a jerky kind of guy. So when he goes through his phase of becoming the bad guy, it's just kind of like him ramped up on it. But he is kind of like, he's not a nice character. He is going through this transformation, and he does it because he doesn't really care about anybody else. He just cares about his ability to do his research and to take himself to that next level, which actually, you think about it, I was thinking about Midsommar while we were watching this, right? And the need for...
Oh, yeah, that's another... Yes, grad students are horrible people. Yes, yeah. Film.
And so, you know...
Which, again, if you're not in higher ed, you don't understand the motivation of those characters who are like, this is my new research angle. You know, and I get, for someone who's gotten a PhD, who has many, many friends who have PhDs, yeah.
Well, he does...
Though outsiders might be like, what? These people are just monsters. And, well, yeah, they are.
Well, at one point when he separates from his wife, he mentions that he hasn't become the star that he thought he was going to become. And he's published, but not published anything.
He hasn't broken through.
And that he's tired of playing the game and of, you know, having to go to the department director's house and, you know, kind of kiss up to him, and that he wants his star moment, which is what leads him to what he does, is he's hoping for this particular star moment. So I think that they also get that right about some academics who really crave to have that star moment.
Yeah.
And it's in a very small sphere of having that star moment, but having that star moment is what he's craving.
So then the other big thematic element of this film I think we need to talk about is the visuals and the sheer I would say balls to the wall, uncontrolled, wild drug visual. I mean, that's something Ken Russell, I think, is, you know, he's someone who is forgotten today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Who at the very least made some very interesting films, almost on that, you know, premise John Waters with Pink Flamingos, where it was like, we decided to make a movie that was like, what can we show? What pushes the boundaries? And I think in a certain way, I mean, we have to do Gothic at some point on this podcast.
Yeah, so Ken Russell, probably his biggest known, like, would be Tommy.
Yeah.
With The Who, is probably people of a certain generation, you say Tommy and they're going to know that movie, mm-hmm. and they're going to know The Who. I actually forgot Ken Russell directed this film. Yeah. This is another film that I saw way too young on late night TV out in Philadelphia. So I wasn't ready for it. There was something, and I hadn't actually revisited it in years. So there was definitely scenes that I remembered, but there's other stuff I didn't remember because I don't think I was ready for it. But Ken Russell would be known for Tommy, but Gothic is his other one for horror fans. And then some people might know White Worm. But beyond that oeuvre, like, he's not a hugely...
Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, I still think that's getting into a niche.
That is very niche.
And then, you know, he does some body horror.
Dante's Inferno is a great film, yeah.
But he does some body horror, which, though, if you want body horror, people typically go to Cronenberg. And Cronenberg's the bigger name in body horror because, like, in the sense of some of the body horror that you see, it's not as, you know, Cronenberger goes hard with his body horror and it's like throughout the film where this has moments of body horror with it. But to what you're saying, the visuals are very, very fascinating and he does.
And I was thinking about that. So I was reading, and again, I mentioned this on Instagram, David Thompson's How to Watch a Movie. Mm. And talking about, for him, it's also how the ability to watch films has changed.
Yeah.
And that now film is something we can experience on a device that fits in our pocket. Whereas when he started getting into a film, he talks about having read about Citizen Kane in a book, and then it was 5 years before he could see Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, you know, this is 1980. Most people had 2 to 4 TV stations.
Yeah.
You know, this is really even before the rise of cable. This is pre-MTV, just pre-MTV. And so it was part of the appeal at the time of this film would have been the psychedelic... I mean, there's points where, you know, the William Hurt character just goes off. I mean, yes, there's parts where he morphs, there's parts where his, you know, body is turning into that of some sort of missing link, half-man, half-ape, original human form. There's also points where he is just supposedly experience the mysteries of creation, or, what does he say towards the end, the complete terror at the dawn of life.
Yeah.
Kind of, there's this existential thing that's happening where he, like, kind of experiences unfiltered consciousness, unfiltered life, which is a lot of, you know, psychedelic lava lamp, oil and light bulb kind of dancing figures on the screen. There's parts where he, like, sort of turns into stone and wails and all of this, which in 1980, when, you know, if you wanted to see those sorts of visuals, you had to buy that ticket to go see that film.
So the funny thing about it for me, though, is that, so Barbarella has some of the same images, and yes. The Matmus. As yes. The evil woman says, the Matmus.
Yes.
The Matmus, like, some of the images are actually, like, the Matmus images in Barbarella.
Yeah.
You know, even 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yes.
There was another film that popped in my head as well. But, I think there was actually some other films that had experimented with that type of imagery with it. So if you saw those films, some of that same imagery came through.
Yeah.
The part actually that I like the best is because if you think about, we probably will take this Freud, Jung.
Yeah, we have to go there too. Let's go
but
there.
But if you think about, part of Freud is that our dreams help us work through repressed memories and mm-hmm. things that we're not ready to deal with. So at the beginning of the film, when he first does a deprivation tank, he is actually processing his father's death. And yes. So there's a lot of actually great religious imagery that happens that's fabulous, that I really adored. And so he sees the beast, and there's crucifixion, and there's all this other stuff that's happening. So that kind of was really interesting to me. When it's just like the flashes of light and things like that, that's not as interesting to me, because I've seen it before in other films.
And we see, and we can just, you know, I mean, remember in 2000 when, like, every music player on your Gateway computer had a visualizer? You know what I mean?
That's true. I mean,
that's what it was. If you remember, I mean, because you think even iTunes used to have it, Windows Media Player used to have it, Real Player, all of those music playing software, they have tunes on the computer, there was a visualizer that was trippy. That is a lot of the visuals from Altered States.
It's true.
I mean, that's what it looks like.
That is actually true.
If you want that with a semblance of a plot, see Altered States. If you missed that experience.
Well, I think, so the author of the film, who, Patty, and I'm not too sure how to say his last name, he actually was the screenwriter for Network. So he's actually, like, that's his opus. He wrote the screenplay for Network.
We could do that one too. So.
The Altered States was actually, which is fascinating, he and Bob Fosse were friends, and they were joking about a way to work together. So they kind of, over dinner, came up with this idea, took it to Dino De Laurentiis, which, if you're a fan of interesting films, Dino De Laurentiis is kind of your go-to guy. And it kind of got shelved, and he turned it into a novel and then into a screenplay. He was so angry with Ken Russell that he actually did not want his name on the film, and so he used a pseudonym for the screenwriter. But he's the same person. He wrote the novel and he wrote the screenplay. So he actually was getting, he was going through psychoanalyst therapy. And so I think you can see he wears Jung on his sleeve.
Yes.
During this. So I think it's from his experience of going through a psychoanalyst that he brings in.
Yeah. Jung. And so the thumbnail sketch, for those of you who are not familiar with Carl Jung, is that, you know, Freud brought to the party that there is this unconscious mind, the iceberg metaphor, that there's part of us that we're aware of, and then there's like 6/7 of us, of our brain, that we're not. And it's the repression, and it's memory, and it's maybe forbidden desire. And what Jung does is carves a piece of that out and says, no, actually, there is also a shared conscious, unconscious mind that there are. And that's how Jung gets into ideas of archetypes and synchronicity, and that maybe there is part of our brain that works together.
Yeah.
And that if we go deep enough into our unconscious mind, we can find that collective unconscious, which very much there's this notion that if the William Hurt character keeps taking this drug and keeps going in that tank, he is going to find the one truth of all truths that unite us or something, and that'll be his big breakthrough. And
he has that speech at the restaurant.
Yes.
That's what he's talking about within the restaurant. And I'm going to say, yes, exactly, in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, like, for Freud gets beat up a lot because I think everyone thinks about the Oedipal complex with him and just his focus on sexuality. But he was the first one to think about our unconscious and thinking about how we deal with things. Mm-hmm. And that has to be brought up in therapy, right? It wasn't that just that there's something wrong with you physically, that there actually could be an emotional state that is happening. So he's kind of the first one who brought that to the table. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, Jung kind of carved out his space of this, you know, collective unconscious and the archetypes. And so William Hurt's character gives a big speech about that he's hoping to do this. And, you know, the part of the collective unconscious is that you can get to the primordial ooze of what it means to be a human being, and that literally happens in this particular film.
Yes, and it looks like early 2000s Real Player visualizer setting of the tunage of your choice, basically.
So with it, so there's kind of some interesting things he does. So Jung is known for the archetypes and then for dream interpretation, and so Definitely Young was an influence on Timothy Leary and other people at that time. They kind of took what Young was doing and brought it in to their fold and have their own theories around it. But Young was looking at this collective unconsciousness, and with that comes the archetypes. And so even with him being in the salt water, that's one thing. Water.
You're from Philly.
Philly, my Philly salt water comes out is that that's actually, you know, Young believes that's salt water is the gate, is a potential gateway to the collective unconscious. And so there's a lot of things in the film that I feel that kind of reference Young along the way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of it is we have to go there of the Great Mother. Mm-hmm. And so you think anything that is a container or a space for Young represents mothers or motherhood. Mm. So like his first trip is in the cave. So that's definitely would be almost like a womb, right? And
yeah.
So the deprivation tanks are definitely a womb, and he is reborn, mm-hmm. you know, and things like that. But on the other side of the mother, the Great Mother, is that there's the Great Mother of bringing life, but there's also the Great Mother who brings death and destruction. And so there's a scene where he's hallucinating his wife, and he's in the cave. We should mention that. He does go to South America, is it?
Yeah, or some like vaguely non-modern global South. I mean, there is a weird colonialism of this film that I think we also have to talk about, where he goes amongst the savages or whatever, and there is this weird racial othering of other cultures and this very kind of retrograde Orientalism.
Yeah.
Of he goes out with the others.
Yeah.
And is it, you know, a reference to Peru and Althusia or Yahe?
Yeah, most likely.
You know, but you just have this, like, sort of, almost like Indiana Jones, where there is just this mismatch of contemporary savages or whatever, and, you know, the body paint, all of those visual tropes.
Yeah.
Yeah, this film has that. As shorthand for non-modern people still living in the world, wherever that is. And yes, they're in a cave.
Yes.
And yes, they have body paint. And yes, there's a hint of cannibalism in their rituals. And a
cave
boiling cauldron and cave paintings. And all of that colonial consciousness, it just uncritically plugs right in and uses it as a plot device.
And so he meets this tribe that's using a drug that they create, and they use the drug to get to the collective unconscious. They all have the same trip together.
Yeah.
And so he, as the white man, joins in, but he can't actually handle it. And so he kind of, it seems like, just goes off the rails with it and has this, you know, so his wife, Emma, he has Emily, he has a hallucination of her, and she's, you know, transforms from a
loser.
She's
naked a lot in this film, too.
She
There's
is.
A lot of nudity in this
there
film.
There is. I think this was her first film as well, too. But she starts off as a lizard, then transforms into a woman. You know, so there's like all this strange imagery, and does he feel like he's being consumed by his wife and their relationship? And so,
which is not, and there's no problematic gender politics in that at all.
And then, of course, he has visions of hell, and he has all these other visions that happen. So, you know, these even some of his visions bring in the Jungian archetypes. Now, I should say I'm not a fan of the collective unconscious. I actually, for me, I don't believe there's this like primordial state that we can get to. Now, I do believe that, you know, there's inherited instinctual things that happen, right? So, like, if you have, you know, many people are afraid of, like, birds flapping around their head, and that's probably an, you know, instinctual thing. Like, we don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
And then with Jung, like, you know, the shadow archetype is probably one of his more famous ones, which is used a ton in films and in fairy tales. I mean, Michael Myers, Jason, they're all shadow figures.
I think that's the thing is, I think, and, you know, Jung is also now a problematic figure because of Jordan Peterson.
Right.
And this attempt, you know, there is this attempt in some archetypal criticism to kind of maybe counteract postmodernism, counteract multiculturalism, or cultural pluralism, that no, there are eternal truths and eternal truths and eternal figures and eternal ideas. When in some cases is it, you know, I mean, you watch like a Jordan Peterson video and he's doing 101 level or actually 12th grade in high school level, like, let's spot the common themes in multiple texts, you know, comparative freshman essays or something.
Yeah.
You know, and well, so that becomes... That is problematic in our time.
Yeah.
Because some of it is, are we getting to internal truth or no? Are we just spotting a bunch of common themes and popular tropes?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, I bring up the shadow because, you know, you think about, like, what were the purposes of like, fairy tales and fables. They were to scare you into doing the right thing, right? Yeah. And those always have a shadow figure, whether it's the wolf or something else to get you. And is it, I don't view that as a common truth. I just view it as a tale that's been told millions of times that we're used to hearing.
Yes, because the device kind of works.
Yeah.
Which then, for me, is then the whole film, because at the end of the film, right, so it's like, they get married. Well, okay, so the Wimhart character fucks a grad student.
Yes.
Which is a thing that has happened in higher ed, which is weird and problematic now, but was once really common, unfortunately. And then from there, you have that he is then dissatisfied with family life. You know, he has children, and he's just like, meh. I mean, that's the weird thing. Like, time sort of passes in this movie, but the characters don't age. But then suddenly there's, like, a six-year-old that's there, and he's still the same age and doing crazy hallucinogenic drugs.
And they're far enough in their careers that they can afford for both of them to travel to other countries.
Yes.
And spend extended time there.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And so he's disinterested, and she still loves him, and he's like, no, I need bigger truths.
Yeah.
And then there's this, like, super bizarre final scene where, you know, and it's like, this is like Kierkegaardian levels of selling out, you know? It's like, we don't know what the world is, so I might as well just be a Christian. In this one, he's like, I've seen the absolute terror of the beginning of life. And he then goes on this, and he's like, I love you and I need you. And then he goes on this trip, and then they touch, and she becomes Lava Woman and is suffering. And then he beats himself against the wall, like that Aha video, but
exactly, take on me,
but Altered States came first. He smashes into the wall until it becomes human again, and then he touches her and they're both naked in the hallway, and they're like, I love you, and heteronormativity, and it's like, there's an infinite terror of being alive, but we can have a family and it'll be nice.
Yeah.
And then they'll just go buy a Volvo station wagon. That's the cut scene after the end. That's the denouement at the end, you know. And that's it. And so it's like, you can, I guess, do crazy amounts of hallucinogenic drugs, but really, you need to settle down and form a family. You know?
Yeah.
And that becomes this, like, there's so many of these weird mixed messages in this film, you know?
Yeah.
And in some ways, I know when we encountered it, in the 90s, this would have had a life on VHS because, dude, stoner movie, you know, because, dude, we could do drugs and then watch this movie about doing drugs and it'll look really cool, you know, which is, and you can listen to Pink Floyd too, but that, and it's the drugs that make Pink Floyd cool when you're doing drugs. Every time I rip on Pink Floyd to another music fan, eventually gets to the point of, dude, but when you're tripping balls.
Same with Fish.
Sorry, folks.
Yeah.
But dude, when you're tripping balls. Yeah, when you're tripping balls, fluorescent lights are interesting. As is perhaps Altered States. Again, at the time, I could see how if you don't have access to those kind of visuals, and if you want a trip and you want to see a film that maybe has these pretensions and has these pretensions of we're going to shatter reality or whatever and get to the real truth, I understand that appeal. But I think for our big five questions, I mean, to watch this film again in 2020, I don't know. I just don't know. And so, yeah, is it camp? Is it retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
Yeah, right. So this is such a tough question. I've been contemplating this one today, because it has pretensions, right? Like it's supposed to be this big, important film. It did make some money, not a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And then of course, as I mentioned, the screenwriter did Network and he did two other Oscar winning films, right? So there's like a prestige with it. You know, part of me just feels like it's an old film.
I'm the same way. I think it's just an old movie. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's just an old movie.
Yeah.
We watched an old movie.
Yes. And that's where we'll leave it. It's an old movie.
Yes. Well, we're not going to leave it because there's four more questions. So yeah, what about the social political distance? You know, Bechdel test, the race. I mean, I talked earlier about the weird colonial. Because there's also then this, like, that the modern... This is, again, this goes back to, like, Rousseau, right? That the modern intellect needs to observe the noble savages.
Yeah.
In order to get past the escutcheons and the facades of modernity and civilization to get to a truth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so busted right
you know,
now.
And I'm reading a book right now, and they're talking about for Africans and, you know, non-white people back in like the 1700s. There was the curse theory was very popular, and like Ham and all this other stuff. And so there's definitely this kind of like massive othering that's happening.
Yes.
Though it's like, though you have this brief experience with it, there is definitely this othering that's happening. The gender for me is very strange as well. So the women that you encounter are his colleague's wife, who's always pregnant. So like anytime you've encountered his wife, she's pregnant and does actually drink. You know, it was this late
alcohol,
70s, 80s, you know, drink alcohol and smoke. But Emily, his wife, you know, when they meet, she's a grad student. She's actually almost done her dissertation.
She's infinitely seducible and easily seducible.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, she mentions that she's 24 and he's like, wow, I was 25 when I got my dissertation. So, you know, and she's obviously a really smart woman. But at the end of the day, like any of her conversations with the colleague's wife are about her relationship with Eddie.
Yeah.
And then also, to what you say with the ending, it comes down to love conquers all, and she's
which is Faust.
Which is Faust, and she's very much, oh, she mentions his obsession with Faust, but very much like her character is, it's really focused on her love for Eddie, mm-hmm. where she just actually just got back from Africa at one point in the movie.
And was doing serious serious groundbreaking research.
And it's really about like, but then she kind of pauses everything to look at Eddie's research,
yes.
And you know, there's this scene where she finally agrees. She agrees to go observe him taking the drug in the deprivation tank. Things go super, super crazy, and she is willing to sacrifice her life for him because her love is just so great for him. Even at the end when she turns into lava, her love is so great
and
for
him. And as soon as she's no longer a lava woman, she's smiling at him adoringly. Like, were you just going through this really incredibly painful experience of being lava? And then suddenly, oh, yay, we're together.
Well, you know, and
we
also,
love each
like...
other, which is like, and he saved her.
He saved her.
And so
and,
she just loves it so much.
And, you know, he leaves her because he wants more from life. And part of him wanting more from life is sleeping with co-eds. And so...
Yeah, he does sleep with one of his
He's not a guy that it's worth going through all this for. And
yeah.
So that part of it is, for me, very problematic. Because I'm like, if she was my friend, I'd be like, leave. Like, why are you even sticking around?
Take the kids and go.
Like, why are you sticking around
with
this guy? He's not a good guy. So that's weird for me because it's like he wrote, it's cool. Like you start out like, oh, this is cool. She has her doctorate and she can go toe to toe with him. But really it's just that, you know, she's enamored with him. And part of me feels like he wrote this character because, we needed to have someone who was worthy of Eddie. And so like she had to have her doctorate for Columbia.
Yeah.
She had to be able to get a position at Harvard like him. So she had to be worthy of this superhuman, of this Superman that is Eddie, because he's just so, so brilliant. And so when you take it in that way, it's horrible, right? That's like really, really horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And but I mean, at the time, normal, expected, unfortunately, you know. And again, that way that higher ed still struggles with its patriarchal, colonial tendencies, they are well on display in this film and from 1980.
And I have to mention the scene where he has his student in bed with him. They've obviously just had sex. He gets up because he cannot control the morphing anymore. And so he'll have these times where the morphing happens.
Yes, where his body reverts to this.
And so he's having problems, goes to the bathroom, and multiple times she's like, Dr. Jessup, are you okay? How creepy is that? How creepy is that yeah. she's a student sleeping with her professor and she
recognizes
him
as
Dr. Jessup. She doesn't even get to call him Eddie. She calls him Dr. Jessup. It's so weird.
Yes. But again, this time. So question three, the technical distance?
Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, go ahead if you want
to
start.
And
with
I have to say, like, I usually say CGI has ruined horror films, CGI has ruined cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the one movie where I would say, you know what, a little CGI, little contemporary yeah. CGI could almost make this film work.
Yeah, there's a couple scenes where because he's like, he does morph into Primal Man, Primordial Man, I guess, mm-hmm. as well, and so there you have a couple scenes where he goes through this morphing process, and then it's almost like, is he morphing back to the primordial ooze? And so he kind of loses structure, I guess is the best yeah. way to say it. That makeup is so bad. Like that, and yes. it's very noticeable. You're like, yes. wow. Now, I think the primitive man makeup isn't horrible, but that is really bad.
And like I said, the real player visualizer stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's still interesting to look at, and the yeah. film was shot in Technicolor, which yeah. I think helps preserve some of it. But if you're going total wild, uncontrolled hallucination, unstructured, yeah. so much of it is that sort of 60s psychedelia oil lamp stuff.
Yeah, and there's a couple scenes where it just looks like the like machine got fuzzy like as they were working, like yes. you know, kind of thing. So I definitely think that yeah, like it's an example of where CGI might have been.
Might have helped.
Yeah.
I think another way this film's dated or not, I think, you know, we talk about the room tests, if there's plot, if there are artifacts, things in the mise-en-scène that make us like kind of take us out of the film. I think it is that. I think you can only watch the drug hallucination visuals under... Well, it was 1980. This is what they could do. This was probably cutting edge for 1980.
Yeah.
You know, this was really trippy. But I can't... You know, we've seen better things since then. And I think most of it, I think it for me, is the social. Is what every... The social relationships between the characters of the room... And this sort of schlockiness, True Love Conquers All, that...
Yeah, I think at one point in the film, because I was getting so annoyed with the characters, I mentioned that I liked the couch. I was like, oh, that's a cool couch.
They, you know, they do have that... That's the other thing, like, academics having that, like, you know, sob-driving, sexy style that academics yeah. sometimes have or are supposed to have. They do that dress-up very well.
So I think they have... this is kind of... branching multiple questions. The men are also a little problematic, right? So like yeah. Mason, who is a physician, he works at the Harvard Medical School, right? So knows what he's doing. Spends most of his time just being yelling.
Yes.
He's frustrated with his friend, but literally his character is just yelling most of the time. And then his other colleague, whose name I forget, is just so passive most of the time.
Yeah.
And then you have Eddie, who is supposed to be the boy genius, who's unhinged. So like, actually even the male characters for me are a little bit strange in this one.
Yeah,
and so I think
they are. Yeah.
I think because there's no really likable characters in the film, it's really hard. Like, there's times in the movie where I was taken out of the movie because I'm like, oh, oh great, he's screaming again. Or, oh, great.
Oh, great, he's ape man again.
Right, exactly.
Oh, he might kill that security guard. Okay.
You know, the maintenance guy seemed nice. He seemed like a likable
character. Yeah, the maintenance guy seemed all right and normal.
I think because it was really... The characters in many ways, in their own ways, were kind of insufferable. There was moments that I was definitely taken out of the film and noticed other stuff with it.
And, you know, and as far as the role of technology in the film, I mean, I think there would have been just the better... The computers would have been better.
Yeah.
Looked better. They would have had, like, futuristic Apple products as opposed to computers that were rooms full of switches. Which, in 1980, computers were rooms full of switches.
True.
Which leads us to our final question, question five. Is it a keeper?
Boy.
Does this fall in that rare category of, and maybe this is part of question one, camp, retro, classic, and all. Yes, it's just an old movie, but is it important old movie? There are things that are important and there are things that are good, and that Venn diagram is not a perfect circle.
This is so true. I do think it's an important movie. I don't think it's good. And so I think it's important in the sense of just even just the film work of Ken Russell and kind of how he tackles topics. And it's actually kind of interesting because Ken Russell and the screenwriter really disagreed, but the screenwriter had complete creative control over the script. And so no dialogue could be changed. And so Ken Russell, in being annoyed with it, if he didn't like the dialogue, he had them either eat or rush through the dialogue if he didn't like it, which I think is amazing.
Yes.
You know, but I also wonder, like, if they were able to work together, would it have worked a little bit better?
Yes, would it made more sense?
But I do think there's a sense of, I do think, you know, it is a modern take on Jekyll and Hyde, which I think is kind of interesting in the sense. And there is something there. He is trying, though for me in sloppy ways, to bring in Jung and that theory around it. So I think there's some unsuccessful things that happen with it. But I do think in terms of horror films, there's a place for it. But I don't think... I don't know. What is your thought?
I agree. And I think to go back to your point about Cronenberg, I think body horror and psychological horror and is, the mind a place of terror. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lofty but failed attempt.
Yeah.
And I do have a soft spot in... I mean... You know, we need to, I think, maybe try to track down a copy of Unbreakable on VHS.
We do.
For this podcast. I have a soft spot for M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
Who is, at times, quite ambitious, but also quite sloppy and quite failed. And it's maybe it's also the idea is this film an interesting failure.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. And I think, you know, just my comment about thinking about it in the history of horror, because 1980, that would have been the slasher film, right? So like that, you know, Halloween is right around that time.
Yeah.
And so the horror took that veer.
Halloween, Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th. Yeah, so Hollywood, like, horror films took that road of the slasher. And unfortunately, I love Halloween. Like, one of my favorites. I love Friday the 13th as well. Those are great. But and what ended up happening with slasher films, they became stupid. And they became silly.
Formulaic.
And they became silly. And so this is fascinating because this is at the same time as the rise of the slasher film. And what is now embraced in horror is this more domestic horror, it's a domestic horror in many ways because it's this relationship and
it's a family
and what's happening to the family dynamic because of one person in the relationship. It does psychological horror pretty well, and I think, and it's not, if you want, like, it's not as, for me, it's not necessarily a scary film. It's an interesting film in that, and so I think now there's much more focus on psychological horror, domestic horror, in kind of that slasher film has gone away. You know, Saul's not even big anymore. And so, like, the biggest films lately have been looking at dynamics and relationships and all this other stuff. So I do think it has, I do think it's a failed film. I think that's a great way to put it. But you can see its imprint on other films as you go forward. And there's, I'm sure there's people who have seen it. Like, you, I just, like, I want to talk to the director of Midsommar and be like, dude, did you watch this? Was this any influence on you? So I do feel like it has, you know, and I think it's one that horror fans, do try to watch because it's known for that focus on the psychological.
Yeah. Interesting failure.
Interesting failure. And that happens sometimes. M. Night Shyamalan has had plenty
interesting
of failures.
So I think if you're looking to be entertained and looking for a popcorn movie, let this one go. Let this one go. But I think if it's, you're like, I want to look up the importance of the, you know, or at least something that is a little off in an interesting way and historically important, it deserves, and which I think is, how much of Ken Russell's career? A little bit off, but historically important. I think we're fans of that sort of... I mean, it's at least a remarkable experience.
Yeah.
If you want a good movie, okay. But maybe sometimes good's a little boring.
Go see... If you want a good horror, domestic horror, go see Piwacket. But yeah, if you want something that is an interesting failure, is a little off, check it out. All right.
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Bye. See you next time.